Tomás, thank you very much indeed, and good afternoon, everyone. It's always, always a pleasure to come across to Ireland and get a chance to meet with colleagues north and south to talk about issues of education. As Tomás says, I think we share a lot in terms of our instincts about high-quality education, but we can learn an awful lot from each other about the way in which those instincts are given expression in our different jurisdictions. I've reached a point in life where I have the illusion of perspective. I think that I can look back over 40 plus years involved in education, and that gives me some kind of insights into the ebbs and flows of education policy and education practice and the kind of things that go on that can, for good or ill, influence directly what our young people experience in classrooms on a day-to-day basis. And I'm conscious that that illusion can also be a delusion of perspective. But if I think back, and Tomás and I were just quickly talking about that over lunch, if I think back to when I started teaching, that was at a time when, in effect, I could do what I liked. My first day, I can still remember it with some terror. I arrived at school, no induction, no preparation in. I think the school started an hour late that morning in order that we could find out about the various bits of admin. And I was simply shown the book cupboard and told, as a history teacher in a secondary school, you know, that's the first year, that's the second year, that's the third year, and then, you know, then we get on to the stuff for examinations. But what you do is up to you, and the head of department showed virtually no interest in what I was doing for the rest of the time that I was in the school, and the head certainly didn't show any interest in what I was doing. So I could do what I liked. And my colleagues across Scotland, similarly, could do what they liked. And that, I think, gave rise to, at one and the same time, some incredibly exciting stuff, because in that context, people could be very creative and had to think for yourself about what it is that you're going to do for young people, and sometimes driven by self-preservation, because some of those young people were very difficult and were not very receptive to that kind of standard form of education, particularly in the school I was teaching in, which was a so-called designated school. That meant I get paid an extra £100 for teaching there, which was 10% of my salary back in 1970, because they couldn't get teachers to go to it because the context was so difficult with a big teacher shortage. And that that period did allow communities of practice in the sense that there were teacher centres, and we got together, colleagues got together, and we talked about what they would have showed each other, examples of what we're doing, worked together on certain things. But in Glasgow, where I was teaching at that time, of the total number of teachers in Glasgow, a fairly small fraction of those teachers would be involved in that kind of community of practice. So what young people got in that context, which was very free, was really a lottery, and it was very dependent on which teacher you got, which school you went to, and the quality of what you got, again, was a lottery. So if anyone says to me there was a golden age in terms of teaching, well, I haven't lived through it, if there ever was a golden age. Things are infinitely better now than they were when I started teaching back in 1970. But partly because of that, politicians increasingly lost faith in the teaching profession and lost faith in what they had previously taken for granted. And we moved from that kind of position where politicians essentially saw their job as being to provide more. So shortly after I began teaching, there was the raising of the school leaving age. So an extra year for young people in secondary school was a self-evidently good thing. And that was a job of the politicians, was to find the resource to make that happen, find the resource to make sure that the schools were staffed and that the buildings were okay. But they weren't interested particularly in what was happening inside those schools, what was happening inside the curriculum. But the period from about the mid-70s onwards, politicians increasingly began to lose faith in what was happening in our schools, Jim Callaghan and the Prime Minister's famous Ruskin College speech, you know, which was very much about we politicians need to get education's too important to be left to professionals, essentially, I suppose, is what he was saying. And we then moved into what has been a 20 or 30 year period where the paradigm has been one of effectiveness and implementation. So that the way in which the policy environment has thought about schools has been largely based on notions of how do we make them more effective and how do we get them to do the things that we want them to do. So the paradigm has been one very much instead of as it was when I started, of basically the profession was in control, individuals in that profession were in control, to an increasingly driven school system, increasingly driven teaching profession. And I think we're now moving into a different phase. And what I want to share with you this afternoon is really my thoughts on the way in which that new phase of thinking about how do we arrive at relevant and high quality education for young people, what might be the characteristics of that new phase. And I want to start with just six propositions that I want to try and deal with in the course of what I say to you, because part of the assumptions back in 1970 were that we knew what was going to happen afterwards. When the children left school, when those young people moved into adulthood, we thought we knew what it was that we were doing would help them in some way, shape, or form. But basically, it was to do with the acquisition, for some of them, of qualifications, and for others, it was a waiting room until they went into some kind of employment. But where we are now, we can't make any such assumptions about the kind of world that our young people, as they move into adulthood and live their lives throughout the entirety of this century, into the next century, many if not most of them, we can't make any assumptions about how they are going to make their way in life. So that the world is changing fast, and the world surrounding schools is giving rise to expectations about what schools can and should do, which are growing, have grown almost exponentially over the course of the last 10, 15 years. We've had a multiplicity of well-intentioned, but often fairly incoherent attempts to reform education across the world. In different jurisdictions, and that feeling that the teaching profession is in some ways part of the problem rather than part of the solution has continued to characterise the way a lot of the policy debate has taken place. How do we make these teachers do things? What is it we can do to try and make sure that they are doing the kind of things that we think are the right things to do? And that's led, I think, to a very reductionist view. It's all about, it has been about effectiveness, but effectiveness in relation to a relatively narrow set of expectations. Often in a policy context, ministers, if they're not quite sure what to do, the one thing you can always do is change structures. So as a minister, if you want to have an impact, change structures, because you can actually do that. Changing cultures, changing practice, much harder, much more difficult to do. And often the policy environment has looked to structural solutions to much more deep-seated cultural problems. And increasingly, measures of effectiveness are about a narrow set of metrics. And all of that gives the illusion that the education system is responding to the changing environment. But the reality is that most of what's happening has either bypassed the classroom or confused teachers in terms of what it is that they are supposed to do. So my first constructive proposition is that I think one of the things that we collectively need to do, and the teaching profession needs to be right at the heart of this, is to help to reaffirm what it is that schools are for, help to reaffirm why it is that young people, we force young people to be at school during those 11, 12, 13 years of their lives. We need to have a binding and compelling vision that we can all sign up to, which is about what school is for. Our problem is that if we look at how you translate ambition and that vision into the reality of what young people experience on a day-to-day basis, the history of that is not a happy one. That relationship between aspiration, in terms of whatever the reform might be, and the reality of what young people experience is at best problematic, and at worst bears little or no resemblance, the end product bears little or no resemblance to the aspirations that came before. So my fifth proposition is that we need to stand back from that, and we need to think much, very differently about the whole process of what is it that leads to that high, that the reality of young people experiencing high quality and relevant education. And the number of things I think that we need to think about very carefully. But the key point in this forum is that the teaching profession should not see itself as being implementers or deliverers of that vision, but should see themselves as owners of that vision and being intimately involved in the whole business of helping to reaffirm why we collectively are doing the job that we're doing and how we can best serve our children. And that is, a lot of that's got to do with values, a lot of that has got to do with that strong sense of purpose, strong sense of mission. And if we are talking about a period of dramatic change, then we have to think carefully about how do schools stay relevant? How does it, where the world is changing round about the school so quickly and in such profound ways, what is it that can be done to try and ensure that the experience that we're giving to young people is actually going to continue to serve them well for the lives that they are going to be leading? So those are my six propositions. And I think embedded in those propositions are some very ambitious challenges. We've got to agree what those ambitious goals are. We can't escape the need that the nature of the learning, the nature of youngsters' ability to learn and learn to very high standard, it has to be at the heart of what we do. So standards, not standards narrowly defined in terms of a small range of metrics, but standards in the broadest sense of being high quality and relevant learning, and certainly literacy, numeracy, but increasingly youngsters' ability to engage with the digital world. And I think education is in a really difficult situation in terms of its relationship to the digital world, because our young people are digitally confident, many of our teachers are not digitally confident, and by and large, both our teachers and our young people are not very digitally competent, can use the technology for very specific purposes, but actually not using the technology. We're consumers of technology rather than users of technology in a creative way. So it's a big challenge for education systems in the nature of the way in which the digital world is changing the rules of the game. And if we think about, just simply think about artificial intelligence, think about enhanced reality, you know, the Pokemon stuff. I mean, think about that. And the way in which the thinking that lies behind that, which is bridging the gap between the digital world and the real world, that's going to have profound implications for the way in which education and learning is delivered in the future. And we need to think about that very carefully. And of course, the ability to use your learning creatively, to use your learning in ways that take it forward rather than simply to regurgitate your learning becomes critically important. There's a huge challenge, I think, in terms of the mission of the school, in terms of developing, helping young people to become rooted and to develop the kind of values and ethical understanding that will allow them to engage with the incredibly complex issues which we face as individuals, in society and as citizens, so that our response to complexity is not to look for a simplistic solution, but that we are rooted in terms of what it is that we believe is the right thing to do, not necessarily what the easiest thing to do is. And that helping young people develop the value systems and the ethical understanding to cope with a very febrile world in which they're living seems to me to be absolutely vital. We've also got this increasing problem of the gap between those who come from more advantaged and those who come from less advantaged backgrounds. And one of the challenges that the teaching profession faces is what's our contribution to defeating the destiny of those young people who come from backgrounds where their future is almost predetermined before they even enter school, let alone in school itself. So what does that mean in terms of a broad, secure and enduring base for young people's learning? How do we create the space for the kind of engaging teaching and learning so that young people enjoy learning? They're not learning simply because it's a means to an end, but they're getting the satisfaction from learning itself. That is what lifelong learning is actually about. If lifelong learning is simply about waiting to have to learn something in order to do something, then you're going to be constantly behind the curve. So again, young people who come out of school, if they've only learned because they have to, then we've equipped them very badly for the kind of world that they are going to be living in. How do we sustain that in a challenging way? And critically in all of that, how do we build the confidence and capacity of our teachers, both individually and collectively? And I want to come back to that because I think we have a real, again, worldwide, there's real confusion about what it means to be a teacher. And we've got to make sure that the accountability cultures, which have grown up around effectiveness and implementation paradigms, don't subvert the kind of context that we're now trying to create for this high quality and relevant education. So we've got a learning challenge. We've got a challenge about what is it that we should be trying to do in terms of our young people's learning, and how can we best organise things in terms of the curriculum and the way in which the pedagogy and the assessment, how can that mix be put together in a way that is going to enable young people to learn the sort of things that they need to learn to make their way in life. But critically, we've got a realisation challenge. How do we make whatever those ambitions are that are embedded in the learning challenge, how do we make them a reality in every school, in every classroom, and for every young person here in the island, in Ireland, or across the islands more generally, and beyond? How do we make it a reality? How do we bridge the gap, the yawning gap that often exists between aspiration and the reality of day-to-day classroom life? So the learning challenge is partly about strategic direction. It's partly about us understanding what it is that we're trying to do. It sounds trite, but actually, if I would lay odds that if you talk to most people, most young people in secondary schools, about why they're at school, and the answer they'll give you will be in terms of qualifications. They're at school to get whatever qualifications might be as well as they can. And is that enough? Is that it? Is being well qualified the same as being well educated? I don't think it is. I think we have a responsibility to think about having well educated young people who are also well qualified coming out of our schools. So how do we agree and pursue those ambitious goals? How do we raise those standards across the board? Subject standards, certainly, but also the literacy and numeracy standards. How do we address issues of well-being, development of ethical understanding and personal values? How do we feed their desire to learn and keep learning? So we've got that issue of strategic direction that we need to think about. We've then got technical design questions to think about. If we're agreed on what it is we'd like to do, what we think is the right thing to do, how do we create a framework that actually does that? And too often what we've done in the past has been to take what currently exists and add to it or tweak it or twist it a bit, but we haven't stood back and asked very hard questions about whether or not the technical design of the way in which we go about trying to realise our aspirations is actually serving those aspirations well, or is it to do with inheritance, the way we've always done things, which we just kind of audit and you know, swap them out a little bit and try and make them fit, squeeze them in somewhere or other so it looks as if it's going to be okay. If you're asked hard questions, you can persuade people that, yes, well, I'm doing that kind of thing. So there are both the strategic and the technical questions. But underpinning all of that is this question, and it's the quote in red on the screen, is part of it. The skills we need in the future will be very different from those needed today. And there's a succession of slides which really say the same thing. The things that we have been very good at in schools in the past are actually not going to serve our children well in the future. The preparation that we've engaged in for our young people in the past and been good at and served them well in that process will not necessarily be right as we move forward. And the Tyler Cowen quote, or quote, series of quotes, kind of makes that point that if we don't, if young people are not coming out of the school system with the skills, knowledge, and dispositions, that means that they can work in a complementary way with the digital world. If we equip them to compete with the technology, then their future is a bleak one. And if you look at some of the quotes on the screen, they're pretty bleak. 47% of total US employment is at risk. Hollowing out of middle-income routine jobs. Technological progress in the 21st century can be expected to contribute to a wide range of cognitive tasks, which until now have largely remained in the human domain, and so on. So the kind of things that, and the way in which we go about the preparation of young people for the future, we may be preparing them for a world that doesn't exist, maybe preparing them for something which we were prepared for, but is actually not going to serve them well in the future. So it's about higher standards, you know, the levels that the young people have got to come out of school with, and whatever we're deciding matters, has got to be as high as we can possibly make it. And we, our pedagogy, the way in which we go about the learning and teaching process, has to be more ambitious than has been the case hitherto, because if you have an effectiveness paradigm, a preparation for examinations or preparation for test paradigm, that's not an ambitious pedagogy. That's an efficient pedagogy, but it's not an ambitious pedagogy. We need to think about that very carefully. A wee bit sobering, some of the figures that are on the screen there. Employer confidence in accessing high-skilled employees in the future by nation. And if you look at Northern Ireland, 2013, positive 29, 2015, minus 27. So I don't know what's happened in that period, and it may partly be an artifact of the way in which the questions were asked. But if you look down that left-hand column, it's very clear that those who are going to be wanting to use our young people as creative members of the workforce and get personal fulfillment from that are not at all confident that what's currently coming out of the school system is doing that. And then if we think about the social trends that have taken place just in a generation, and this process is, we ain't seen nothing yet. So the world that I was born into bears almost no resemblance to the world that my grandchild was born into 10 weeks ago. And her children, the world will bear no resemblance to that kind of world either. So if we ever in the past kind of assumed that there was stability, social stability that we're talking about, that's certainly not an assumption now, because the pace and nature of change is increasing dramatically. So all of that can paint a kind of bleak picture, but the reality is that it's simply new baselines that we're talking about, and that the question is, how do we ensure that our young people are ready to engage with this world? Because there will be volatility, there will be insecurity, there are issues to do with migration, but also huge opportunities. Again, certainly Theresa May there, actually. Well, you know, that kind of situation is the reality. Complexity is a feature of society today. Greater diversity, greater inequality. Ambiguity in citizenship, the kind of issues that we're dealing with personally and as citizens, don't lend themselves to simple right-wrong responses. They're ambiguous. They do require us as individuals to not be afraid of complexity, but also to be well-rooted in terms of our own values. The whole business of connectivity and issues of cyber security. And then that business of collective learning, innovation, or do we end up, because this will happen. You know, the nature of learning, how young people learn, is going to change. And if the school system doesn't embrace that and work with it, and if our teachers don't embrace that and work with it, they'll become obsolescent. That different ways will be found, and youngsters and their parents will find different ways of engaging with the with learning, and we can see elements of that already exist, but they will grow dramatically in the course of the next few years. And the John Dewey quote, I think, sums it up beautifully. If we teach today as we taught yesterday, we rob our children of tomorrow. Written in 1915. And that's part of the kind of reflection I'm having just now. That we have a very powerful machine in our school system. We have a very powerful body of men and women in the school system who are desperately wanting to do the right thing by their children. And we could sleepwalk into not allowing that resource, that very powerful resource, to actually serve young people as the way it should. So the kind of things that need to characterise 21st century schooling, and I'm not going to go through all of those because they reflect what I've said before, but the basic point is that increasingly where we define the curriculum in terms of inputs, we define the curriculum in terms of youngsters' access to learning. So we chunked the curriculum in terms of so much of this and so much of that, so much of the other, gave youngsters an entitlement. This is all good stuff. It's all right. But the shift, I think, that's taking place now is from not just what they should be learning, but what they become as a result of that learning. How are they able to use that learning in order that they grow and develop as people ready to engage with the world of today, but particularly the world of tomorrow? Across the world, over the course of the last 20 years, 15 years, countries increasingly talk about what it is they want to do, what they want schools to do, in terms of that what they want young people to become as people, rather than defining it purely in terms of inputs. The exception to that actually would be England, whose definition of the curriculum still tends to be a very input-based definition. But by and large, the trend is away from a purely input-based definition of the curriculum towards one that's much more about how do we use all of that very powerful body of knowledge that we have in order to help our young people grow and develop. So the themes are, if you look across the world, ambitious goals, increasingly directed towards the development of the person, trying to strike the balance, and the balance is different in different countries, between basic skills, subject knowledge, ability to apply knowledge creatively, and this broader preparation for future life. When we are talking about the broader preparation for future life, tends to be talking about lifelong learning, about citizenship, about creativity, about personal well-being and personal efficacy. And through all of that, there's this pervasive tension between the kind of things that are said in policy documents and the kind of things that youngsters experience on a day-to-day basis in schools, in many schools. So the question then becomes about this realisation challenge. And is the paradigm of implementation, is the paradigm of effectiveness, the right paradigm for us to think in the future about how you produce high-quality education in a highly febrile environment? Quotes on the screen, I've said that already. Schools are designed for a quickly vanishing world. That's part of the issue that we face. The reform conundrum, and this is a tiny fraction of research, people in this room are very well aware of it, about that gap between intention and reality. The John Hattie quote, we have an education, a long history of innovation, but it rarely touches but a chosen few, is a very powerful statement of what I've been trying to say. And what seems to happen is that there's a kind of vortex at work where our ambition, what we'd like to do, gets reduced and gets sucked into a much narrower and certainly less ambitious, in some ways quite a mean interpretation of what we're trying to do. And you can see the arrows are a set of things that may contribute to that. And we're well aware of that conundrum, but if we stick with the paradigm of effectiveness and implementation, then that takes it along the road of saying, how do we stop this happening? Well, we need better teachers, we need better leadership, we need less prescription, we need more collaboration, we need rigorous accountability. But the danger is that we end up in an improvement trap. So all of that simply contributes to us getting better at things that are less and less relevant, us getting better at a narrow subset of those things that really matter in terms of children's education. So if we stand back and say, how on earth do we address this question? Because we're doing stuff around better teachers and better leadership. We're getting more collaboration going. We're doing lots of things that are designed to try and make things better. Publication, which many will be aware of, Governing Education, A Complex World, by Tracy Burns and colleagues in OECD, talks about the context within which we are all working has become increasingly complex, and that again makes the notion of a delivery model, an effectiveness implementation model, increasingly hazardous. There is a move away from strict hierarchies. You know, you can pass things down the line, and people will do what they're told as the message is passed down the line. There's a lot more independence in the system, or autonomy in the system, in pockets, a lot more self-regulation, and governance is increasingly multi-level in terms of where the power of decision making lies. So the notion that somebody up there takes a decision and somebody down there does it, and the chain from there to there just makes it happen, the history of reform suggests that was never a good way of thinking about things, but certainly in the kind of world we're talking about, that's unlikely to work. So they go on to talk about what are the kind of things that might begin to shift this gap between ambition and reality. Now, part of it is about not seeing those who are engaged directly in the learning and teaching process as implementers of somebody else's view of what's right, but increasingly all of those who are involved in young people's learning are part of the process, so you create a lot more ownership in the system of what we're trying to do, rather than alienation in the system, which can often happen where decisions seem to be taken elsewhere. We're recognising the need to see things see this as an ecological system, that the things all interact in complex ways. It's not something where you can just see a simple chain of command. We need to think hard about the alignment that's taking place inside the system. We've got to get faster in our response times to changes in the system. So we're talking, and I think Tomás talked at the beginning, we're talking about adaptive systems, not systems that simply react to problems slowly, but systems that are actually part of the process, that problems haven't become a problem. You're actually adapting in order to stop a problem becoming a real problem and being damaging. So what we're looking for is sticky change. You know, it's the kind of change that is actually going to stick at the level of the classroom or the level of the teacher. So if you take all of that stuff and the OECD stuff, the challenge it faces us is about hearts as well as minds. It's not enough to explain to people why this is the right thing to do. They've got to believe it. They've got to have a banner to march behind, which they say, yes, that's what I believe is the right thing for children. And we haven't always been very good at doing that. We've got to recognise that the whole business of how you arrive at high quality education for young people is messy. It is simplistic to think of it in any way as an RD&D model that you can just roll out and think of it in terms of effectiveness implementation. There's something about the medium being the message, that the way in which we go about the process itself helps to shape what it is that we're trying to do in the first place. It's a much messier process than a simple linear development process. We need a continuous learning system for all of us. and our colleagues across the country. We've got to get a much more sophisticated understanding of what leadership means. And if we shift the paradigm, leadership in an effectiveness implementation paradigm is very different from leadership in a collaborative culture change paradigm. Different kind of leadership altogether. And the risk is that we stick with former views of what good leadership is, and essentially that's often tied up with the leader or leaders, and not as leadership as something which is more of a collective responsibility. So there's something about the nature of leadership in professional organisations that we need to think about much more carefully, and we need to invest a heck of a lot more in terms of building the individual and collective capacity of practitioners, particularly the teaching profession, so that the whole profession is engaged in this process of mutual learning, knowledge mobilisation in a whole lot of different ways. And of course, we've got to get accountability culture that works in sympathy with us and is constructive, not a break in it all. So we need to move from the previous models of how you bring about change, which essentially have been an outside-in model. They've been about how do we force these wretched schools and these wretched teachers to do things that they're so reluctant to do, and move to one where we're talking about hearts as well as heads, and we're using the power of networks, of collaboration, communities of practice, so that those who are engaged in the teaching process are nourished by working in collaboration with colleagues and sharing both the challenges and also the opportunities with colleagues. We need to think about, in all of that context, what are the promoters and drivers inside the system, and how do we make sure that those promoters and drivers are working in ways that are going to help us to move forward. And that's why I think we do need to, and Tomás mentioned this at the start, we need to shift the paradigm away from effectiveness and implementation, away from assuming, as the quote that's up there, you know, if you take a McDonald's franchise, then the definition of quality is you do what you are supposed to do. So a McDonald's in Armagh and a McDonald's in Glasgow and a McDonald's in St. Petersburg look the same. Highly predictable. Quality is defined by being the same. The same, you know, broadly. The franchise you buy into is you will create something that looks like this, and the test is faithful implementation with minimal change. But actually, in educational terms, how we go about high quality, producing high quality, is not like that. That's what we've tried to do, either implicitly or explicitly in the past. And we need to be much more... We need to have much more humility about suggesting that anyone has the right answers, that there is a right answer, a right way of doing things. That's what a learning culture is about. It's not there is a right way, I just have to copy it. It's about how do we engage in order to arrive at the right thing to do in this particular context. And therefore, I think the paradigm needs to move towards one which is about the strategic exploration. It's where we commonly agree about the direction we want to go in. We commonly agree about the nature of what good looks like in terms of the kind of education that our young people need to have. And then we explore in every school how we can best realise that given the resources that are available and given that we learn from colleagues and from research and from other contexts. And all of that's got very profound implications, I think, for what it means to be a teacher. Some may have heard me saying this before. When I wrote Teaching Scotland's Future, I thought mischievously, I didn't really think of it, but I could mischievously have subtitled it Goodbye, Mr. Chips. Because the reality is that what made a good teacher in the past may be wholly inappropriate for the kind of context within which the learning and teaching process is going to take place in the future. And we are all conditioned by our own experience as young people or as colleagues in a school situation. So we all have a view of what a teacher looks like, and that view is a rear view mirror view of what a teacher looks like. So we need to think very carefully about if this profession, if schools are going to continue to be relevant and at the cutting edge of what's needed, what do we mean? How do we build our teachers in order that they're able to do that? And that's of course about expertise. It's also about their values. It's also about taking responsibility for your own development. So you're not waiting to be trained and then moaning that the the insect course you've gone to wasn't very good, therefore you're not going to bother about it. Your job as a professional is to be ready to do your job. Your job as a professional is, however poor my performance is today, take something from it. You know, take something from it that will allow you to move forward. Don't just sit with arms folded and say, well, that wasn't very good, was it? And think about how you take how teachers can take responsibility for their own development and sustain that development. And we've not been good at that. I mean, not been good in terms of the messages we've sent to the profession and to teachers about what we expect of them and of ourselves. And that's both individual and collective. If we get that right, then professional learning becomes one of the drivers of educational change. Instead of professional learning being about learning how to implement something, professional learning becomes much more profound, and it becomes part of the whole process of thinking about what's the right thing to do and how do we best explore what's possible in our own context. And that means that we have got to engage in well-planned, well-researched innovation and be very research active and research aware. Partly the implication is who becomes a teacher. We've got to, I think, from a policy point of view, and it's incredibly difficult for ministers because the teacher supply tends to ebb and flow a bit. And the point at which you don't have enough teachers, the pressure is on to get bodies in front of the class. You know, so it's got a pulse, drag it in and stick it in front of the class. But actually, we need to be much, much more selective in terms of what it means to be a teacher. As I say, I called my report Teaching Scotland's Future, and that I think we are teaching Scotland's future, but teaching is Scotland's future, and teaching is Ireland's future. And we need to think about that, what it then means to be a teacher, and how we ensure that the kind of people that we have are people who want to grow and learn throughout their career, not who want to be like the teacher they had 20 years ago, or whenever it might be, and just recreate the past. But they want to grow and learn and be relevant for their children as they move forward. That means that the formation phase of the first few years, the early phase of a career, become incredibly important, because that's when the benchmarks are set. There's a huge amount of chance at the moment in terms of both initial teacher education and the early experience that our young teachers have, huge amount of chance as to whether or not they're exposed to the kind of situations that give them high aspirations, high standards to aspire to. We need to get that continuum, career-long learning, going. We need to make sure the professional development that we use, time, as we all know, is the key currency in a teacher's life. And the worst thing we can do is to give them professional learning that they don't see the point of, and they're just going through the motions. And it isn't very effective in any case, even if they do take it seriously. And being research aware and research active. So that's about, there's a whole range of things that I think we need to do if we're going to succeed in that, and I'm not going to go through all of that. I talked about leadership. There's no earthly point in building the capacity of our teaching profession if what we end up with is teachers who are champing at the bit, and they operate in a context where they're not allowed to do things, you know, where the leadership doesn't understand, wants to control, wants to close down the agenda, wants to make sure that the school plays safe, is more concerned about the school looking good and the school being good. So the nature of leadership, creating the context within which if we have got a teaching profession that is more confident and competent, we need leadership that understands how to work with that and use it. And there's a whole range of stuff I don't need to rehearse with you here about the importance of leadership. I think the piece of research that was done, this New Zealand piece of research, is quite interesting because it shows that, or suggests, that the single most important thing a leader can do is to develop a staff. So if I were back as head of the inspectorate in Scotland just now, the discussion I'd be asking my colleagues in the inspectorate to have when they're involved with colleagues in schools, first question would be about that. What have you done to build the quality of your staff? What's the way in which you have built quality in your staff? How do you ensure high quality professional learning for your staff? Because that's the most important thing that you can do, or one of the most important things that you can do if you're going to be effective as a leader. So we've got to move away from an implementation effectiveness paradigm, and we're moving into a paradigm which is more complex, but potentially, I think, going to produce something that's much more exciting and relevant for young people, then we need to move away from a followership culture where somebody's got the answer, whatever that might be, and your job is to follow the leader, find a leader and follow them. So if we are talking about that culture of leadership rather than followership, it's about sense of purpose, it's about sense of mission, it's about getting a culture right inside a school, it's about a relentless focus on capacity building of staff. It's about using professional standards creatively, not simply as a mechanism for performance management, but creatively inside the school to build the quality and growth of staff. It's about tapping into discretionary effort. Everyone in this room will know, all of us, if you believe in something, you give a bit more. If you don't believe in it, you do enough. Now, the real test of a leader is the ability to release that discretionary effort so people do more than they have to do. And they want to do it because they believe in it and they want to be part of that process. That's a real skill, and our best leaders are brilliant at that and that's to do with ownership and culture and all the things that go with that. And a critical part of leadership is protecting teachers from all the outside stuff, all the noise that goes on in the system, crudely. Or rather, not crudely, but in jargon terms, manage the authorising environment. Manage that environment that goes on round about the school that says, yes, this is all right, or no, we're not happy about that. And a critical part of that authorising environment, of course, are the parents, because the parents, quite rightly, are nervous if a school doesn't look like the school that they went to, if teachers don't look like the teachers they had, if what the kids are getting doesn't look like the sort of things that they got when they're at school. So a critical part of leadership is about helping to manage that environment that allows the school to do the right thing, and helping to enabling those who are the critical people in terms of the stakeholders for the school to want to be part of this and to see the point of it. I won't go through all of that because it just simply rehearses what I've already said in a variety of different ways, but we need to think. That means that we've got to think of schools as learning schools and the characteristics that are on there. You can agree or disagree with, but they're certainly the kind of things that if all our schools looked a bit like that, I think we'd be in quite a strong position, and there is no reason why most of our schools, if not all of our schools, can't look a bit like that. So if we do all of that, I think what we do is to release energy in the system that currently is depressed. Where teacher unions or teachers are complaining about workload, fundamentally what lies behind that is they don't really believe in what they're being asked to do in the first place. They feel alienated from it. So we need to think about how we release energy inside the system. And I think the kind of things that I've been talking about are worth thinking about as part of the process of how we release that energy. And if we get that right, then I think the chances of giving our young people a much more relevant and higher quality education are increased. Just want to finish by saying a couple of things about where I've been doing some work recently. Well, in Scotland, work over a 40-odd year period, but looking at Scotland, that engaged in fairly major curriculum reform, called Curriculum for Excellence, in the middle of the last decade. It's now about 10 years on. OECD were brought in and asked to do a review of progress with that curriculum reform. By and large, they were pretty impressed. Sometimes if you read the media, you might think that it's not working well. The reality is that the evidence that we have, such as it is, would suggest that by and large, Curriculum for Excellence is going in the right direction. But what the OECD say is you don't have a strong enough handle on this. You're looking at developing so-called four capacities in young people in the round, but a lot of the data that you have or the evidence that you have doesn't relate to all of that. It relates to a subset of that. So you need to get much better at ensuring that the evidence that you have is building up that relates to the totality of what it is that you're trying to do. But by and large, the OECD review was and certainly interpreted by Scottish Government and others as being encouraging, that they actually used the phrase that it's you have the opportunity to be one of the leading countries in the world in terms of the curriculum. So they said some very positive things about happening in Scotland, and Scotland are trying or are adopting a systems approach. They're trying to bring together a lot of the things that I've been talking about. I think Scotland's at an interesting point. I think over the course of the next year to 18 months, we'll get a better idea about the way in which the aspirations, the ambition, which is embedded in Curriculum for Excellence, can be better made a reality in schools throughout throughout Scotland. Scotland certainly isn't there yet, but it has the potential, I think, to do something really quite interesting. The other example is Wales, and I've been doing quite a lot of work in Wales recently. The Welsh Government asked me to undertake a review of curriculum and assessment arrangements in Wales. I'm not absolutely certain that the Minister quite knew what he was letting himself in for when he asked me to undertake that review. I think he thought I was going to tweak the national curriculum and tell him how he could solve some of the problems of they were finding it hard to squeeze things in. There was lots of pressures building up, and going, God, what are we going to do about this? We'll ask somebody from outside to come and have a look at it and see what they do. So the deal that I did with Minister and officials in Wales was if the research that I do takes me in radical directions, are you up for that? Or are you simply looking for something that is fairly minimalist in terms of change, but we'll do a job? Now, both ministers and officials said yes. You know, do your worst. See what comes out of it. And what I did was to the review took about 9 months, and I spent the first 4 to 5 months touring Wales, north, south, east, and west, centre. Wales is a lot more difficult to get about than I thought, I have to say. But it's north and south are very very different beings and separated by a rather awkward set of mountains. But what came through to me very strongly, very quickly, as somebody who was independent, and therefore they didn't have to worry about me, they could say what they thought to me. One, they were very critical of the existing national curriculum. It was very clear after a very short period of time that the good things that were happening in schools were happening despite and not because of the national curriculum. And schools were apologising and saying, not sure we should be doing this, or don't tell anyone, but we think this is quite interesting. So that they were operating, they were kind of being subversive, they thought they were being subversive, because the national curriculum, as it had evolved over the period since 1988, had become increasingly unwieldy, overcrowded, it had lost credibility, it was increasingly irrelevant. But it was still the law, so it was in statute, therefore you had to do it. So the report that I produced for Wales, called Successful Futures, was very radical. It made 68 recommendations that spanned really most of what I've spoken to you about this afternoon. It talked about strategic direction, it talked about technical design, and it talked about the things you have to do to make it that increase the likelihood that it will become a reality in every school, in every classroom, for every young person in Wales. And the Welsh Government produced a document called Curriculum of Wales, Curriculum for Life. They accepted all 68 recommendations. They've put in place a massive reform programme, I have to say, a somewhat daunting reform programme, a massive reform programme. And they've produced this, which is, if you look at it, it's got the sky blue stuff are building blocks, the bits around the outside are enablers, and critically the bit in the middle is about the mission, is about what is it that we're trying to do. And there are four purposes which go back to what I said to you earlier in terms of the kind of thing. Nothing surprising or shocking about those. They are appearing in policy documents all over the world. But what has tended to happen is for those fine words to be consigned to policy documents. What we've been trying to do in Wales is to keep those right at the heart, so all of those building blocks, all of those enablers, are all geared to try to make sure that young people in Wales will be developing ways that fulfil those four purposes that deal with the sort of things that I've been talking about. So they've tried to get a strategic and inclusive approach. based on agreed purposes. So back to what I said earlier about this compelling vision. So far, 18 months on from publication of the report, the levels of enthusiasm in Wales, and that's cross-party enthusiasm in the Welsh Assembly, all of the major political parties are signed up to it. New minister came in, she signed up to it, very enthusiastic about it, in fact. Teacher unions are supportive of the reform programme. And the, you know, the broader community is probably in a state of suspended animation about it, but there's certainly as yet we haven't yet hit the negativity that one might anticipate for something as dramatic as this, because there's always winners and losers in a reform of this kind. So they've got that inclusive approach based on agreed purposes. I've tried in Successful Futures to reflect the sort of things that I've been saying to you today about what makes for successful reform. That means it's not a top-down effectiveness implementation model. And I've got with the civil servants in Wales, and they won't mind me saying this because I say it everywhere with them there. I've got a swear box, and every time they talk about delivery or implementation, they say, put money in the box. It's about realisation. It's about making it a reality, not about delivery. Not about implementation, it's about making it a reality, and that reality will be created in different ways in different contexts. We'll see where we end up, but I think there'll be the legislation will be fairly minimalist. If we end up that they're only doing it because it's in legislation, then the whole thing will have failed. So I think we'll move away from a national curriculum which has got, you know, 12 programmes of study and cores and you know, a very detailed prescription about what's to happen. So I think that the end product will be much less specified in statute than has been the case up until now. And they've created what they call a pioneer network, and that's about 200 schools across Wales that are involved in both developing the curriculum and working out whether the curriculum as it's being developed can actually be made a reality in the classroom. So the notion of schools being at the heart of the process of development, this is not a group of experts putting wet towels around their head and producing a curriculum and then telling everybody else to do it. The schools will be intimately involved in the process of trying to develop this curriculum. So we're trying to get that balance between aspiration, ambition in the curriculum, but rooted in the reality of the classroom and the reality of what teachers believe is possible. It's going to happen over quite an elongated timescale. History in Wales has been of things being dished out and people told to do it instantly, but actually we're now talking about 2021, 2022 being the point at which this should be have worked its way through. It deals with the kind of things that I've talked about more generally. They're embarking in the process of looking at the leadership culture in Wales, and we're also they've had a very they've had an approach to accountability which has had a tight grip on the system. And one of the things that's consistently said to me is, "This is all very well, but what will the inspectorate say?" Or, "This is all very well, but we've got the tests and results are all that really matters at the end of the day." What I've got Welsh Government to agree to is that they have suspended looking at accountability. We're going to design a curriculum assessment approach to pedagogy, which is the right thing to do, and then we're going to think about accountability rather than saying you can't do this because it can't be measured. Question. So we'll see what happens. Interesting. So that was my six propositions. You will see from what I've been saying to you that I'm struggling with all of this. I am reflecting on 40 odd years of experience, reflecting on the evidence that we have from across the world, reflecting on the emerging research evidence, both about the nature of the curriculum and about how you make it a reality. I think this is all about exploration, though. That's the paradigm I think that we've got at the end. There isn't a template or a model that I can present, and I keep on saying this to people in Wales. I don't have the answers, you know. You've agreed with me this is the direction we want to go in. Let's explore it together. Let's see what we can do. Let's see what the possibilities are. So, watch Wales. We'll see over the course of the next 2 or 3 years. It could be pretty interesting one way or the other. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Graham. So before we move into the panel discussion, just very briefly, I suppose, to thank you for a wonderful keynote. And you will have an opportunity to raise questions in the Q&A that will be the substance, essentially, of the panel discussion. Graham will remain on the stage for the panel discussion and have an opportunity to raise any questions you want to arising from his keynote at that point. Very briefly, to acknowledge some of the key points you've made in that keynote, Graham, about exploration, a big emphasis on values, I think, throughout, underpinning a lot of what you're saying, and reminds me of what Etienne Wenger was saying earlier on about the importance of values. And of course, Nick Noel Purdy pointed out, of course, that's a very contested concept in itself and the meaning of that word, but there was a strong emphasis on us being clear as to what we value and why we value it. And I picked up four illusions in your keynote. Firstly, there's the illusion of the golden age in the past. Second illusion of a structural change presenting itself as a responsive change. Third illusion of Pokemon Go. If I ever thought I'd hear you mention Pokemon Go in a keynote, I think I would have been kidding myself, but there you go, you use it. And the fourth illusion was that top-down change is how it actually happens when it's not. So for those four illusions alone, that's my at least four insights from the keynote amongst many others. Can I now hand over to Professor Teresa Doherty, who will now chair the panel discussion that was the next part of the conference program.